You know how sometimes in life you say something you regret?
I've been a bit underwhelmed, if I'm honest. It feels a bit like the first Tour de France fam, or the rejuvenated, reborn Tour de France fam.
That's me, talking about the first women's grand tour of 2023, the Vuelta Femenina, which turned out to be an absolute banger. So now I've been banished to cycling Alcatraz, a mountain fortress somewhere in the arid and remote Southern Alps where I must contemplate my failings. That also explains why, as we are recording, you may hear the cry of a distant eagle, shouts from drunken hunters in the valley far below, the mournful baying of caged hounds, distant rolling thunder, the scramble of a desiccated lizard, the breeze blowing through a rocky outcrop. Hello again and welcome to the second episode of Radio Cycling, bringing you the key news stories within professional bike racing in partnership with Sigma Sports. Here's the news. Vuelta Belta, Van Vleuten and Vollering duke it out on Covadonga. COVID in the Giro, we get the inside track on the return of the virus. Back from the brink, how Cordon Ragot became cycling's ultimate survivor. And lost in space, Lance Armstrong, space cadet. From a new road bike to a wardrobe refresh, Sigma Sports keeps you moving, whether you're a commuter, racer or social rider. At Sigma Sports, you get the products you want from the brands you love. With fast shipping, easy returns and industry-leading customer service, shop in-store or online at sigmasports.com. My name's Jeremy Whittle, and joining me from his own mountain lair is the multiple award-winning author and journalist Peter Cossins. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Jeremy.
And also with us, poised at the mic in his luxury penthouse apartment in the smarter suburbs of Valencia, Chris Marshall-Bell. Hello, Chris.
Hello to you, Jeremy.
Pete, last time we spoke, Chris and I were both a little underwhelmed by the opening stage of the Vuelta Femenina, while you were very enthused. Turned out, obviously, that you were right again, and we were rewarded with a gripping weekend's racing in northern Spain. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, it was good, wasn't it? I mean, it was... It turned out to be a great grand tour. I mean, a couple of people picked me up on Twitter and saying it was like the first, this was the edition of the Vuelta was the first grand tour, bearing in mind the Vuelta had been run before, but this was like a week-long edition, finished on Lagos de Covadonga with a classic stage. But we had controversy going into it. On Saturday's stage, the race was turned upside down when... Annemiek van Vleuten's Movistar team attacked early on in the stage, and we're not quite sure exactly whether Demi Vollering, the race leader, was having a wee or not, but she claimed she was. Movistar said they didn't know that she was and attacked anyway. Trek helped Movistar drive the brake along, and basically Vollering lost her lead. She lost the red jersey. Van Vleuten took it over. Although at the stage finish, Trek's Gaia Realini won the stage. And then on the final day, which was an absolute cracker of a stage, I have to say, to Lagos de Covadonga. I mean, it's been, for me, I felt that whole weekend was, I don't know, I guess it was a confirmation of that race, but it was also marked a change in women's cycling, I think. Seeing them racing up to like a classic summit finish in Asturias, a climb obviously which kind of remembered for all kinds of victories, for Miguel Indurain refusing to ride up there in the 1996 Vuelta and retiring. And this kind of added to it. We had this great duel between these three riders, between Van Vleuten, Vollering came back, and Realini again, who's a real discovery. And Vollering and Realini managed to drop Van Vleuten on the... going through the Huesera, the boneyard, as it's known, this really steep bit of Covadonga. And they got away from her. And her lead was, I think I'm right in saying, a minute and 11 seconds over Vollering. And it reached a point where Vollering had almost clawed back the lead. And by the time she... I mean, if the climb... I mean, I don't know whether people know Covadonga or we're watching on TV on Sunday, but towards the end of Covadonga, there's a couple of descents, And if the basically if the climb had kept going up, Vollering would have won. Not only the stage as she did, but also the red jersey, she would have regained it. But those couple of descents near the end probably saved Van Vleuten. She hung on to win by, I think it was 9 seconds in the end, or maybe 5 seconds actually. Raiolini was boosted herself up to third on the podium. Vollering was second, and it was just an absolute corker of a race.
It was, wasn't it? It was really excellent. And I think one of the things that women's racing needed when it kind of started, when they rebooted the Grand Tours for women, was it needed rivalries and duels. It needed a bit of edge and it needed a bit of mythical landscape. And we got all of that, didn't we, in the final weekend of the Vuelta. What did you think of it, Chris?
I thought it was absolutely thrilling, Jeremy. As Peter so eloquently said, it had everything. It had the mythical landscape, it had the rivalry, it even had the typical Northern Spain weather. And I think it has advanced women's cycling to that extra level. And you've just touched on the rivalry there. And while it's been fantastic to see Demi Vollering's progression over these last 12 to 18 months, there still appears to be a bit of a gap between herself and Van Vleuten and the rest. But just these past 7 days, although you could extend it to the past 2-3 months, we've seen another potential huge rivalry come to the fore between Vollering and Raiolini. Raiolini's only 21 and Vollering's 26, I'm writing same. But I think we've seen this week that these two could be the climbs that really come to dominate women's cycling in the next 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So, yeah, I think it was a real turning point in the development of women's cycling.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, let's move on and catch up with the latest from the Giro d'Italia, which has obviously left the opening weekend. We had that explosive start from Remco Evenepoel. Things have been relatively calm. We've had Michael Matthews picking up a stage win. So his kind of up and down relationship with Grand Tour seems to be on the upwards trajectory at the moment. And we've been treated to a couple of long sprint stages, some of which I think was enough to cure insomniacs, if I'm honest. But meanwhile, the threat of COVID is still hanging around. And Chris, you've been looking into this.
Yes, I have, Jeremy. Despite the spectre of COVID hanging over the Giro, it appears that there is next to no sign of COVID bubbles being reintroduced to protect the riders. And while that does make sense, you know, we've all moved on as a society. When you see just before the race that Jumbo-Visma had to pull a few riders from their team due to the virus, and Trek Segafredo also with Giulia Ciccone, you do start to wonder whether these biggest of races, these races that cycling relies on essentially, if they're being affected, should we be having some COVID measures reintroduced? I was speaking with Trek's head doctor Nino Daniele yesterday, and he explained to me how right now there are no mandatory UCI protocols, as we've seen at races, certainly the races that I've been to this year. And the COVID cases that we have seen in the last week appear just to be bad luck. In Jumbo's cases, it sounds like they all picked them up at the Ardennes, and coincidence or not, Trek Segafredo were sharing the same hotel there. Nino informed me that Ciccone's first, that Ciccone's COVID case was actually the team's first since November. So does it appear to be a case of bad luck? But with the threat of COVID variants coming and different type of waves, I think this overall threat of COVID hasn't left us behind just yet. I think the last thing that we want to see, Jeremy, is the farce that we witnessed at last year's Vuelta a España, when a number of high-profile riders like Simon Yates and Sam Bennett had to abandon around stage 10, I think it was. So let's hear what Daniel had to say about keeping the peloton safe at the Giro.
I don't think they will take the decision to introduce a bubble. You know, it's not easy to organize a bubble when the rules doesn't make it mandatory. I mean, in the UCI protocol, it's actually one of the paragraphs where they say that in case of a new wave or something bad, they can reintroduce again rules. But at the moment, actually, I don't think they will introduce any new rule in this moment. I mean, for sure that they will observe how is the situation. Maybe they will take some decision for the next races.
So that's Nino Daniele there. But one of the interesting developments I've noticed in the peloton in the last kind of, I don't know, 9 months, I suppose, really, is a bit of a blame game really developing amongst the top riders when, you know, somebody caused a racing incident where there's a crash. It used to stay within the peloton, but now riders are being outed much more. I mean, if we think back to last year's Vuelta when Primoz Roglic crashed after tangling with Fred Wright, and then he and his team Jumbo Visma really doubled down on Fred Wright, and kind of he was widely blamed for the injuries that Roglic suffered. Then, obviously, in stage two of the Giro, which we've just had, we saw Remco Evenepoel outing and blaming Caden Groves. It didn't take much detective work to work out who was going to get the blame, if I'm honest. But then we also saw in the Tour of Flanders this spring, we saw that mass crash when Philippe Mackiejouk came off the road and then rejoined the peloton and took about 40 riders down and then apologised profusely and, you know, was kind of in disgrace. Is this a good thing? I mean, these are rider errors, aren't they? They're not intentional, they're just errors. Is this a good thing that their dirty washing is being aired in public, do you think?
I think it's interesting the way it's developed, doesn't it? There's almost like a VAR type aspect to it. I mean, a bit like when football matches get stopped and they go and look at the cameras again, and the kind of the riders have almost appointed themselves to that role. I mean, whether it's a new development, I'm not entirely convinced. I think it's probably always been there. That what's happening is that because there's so much more coverage of cycling and so much more focus on what's happening in the sport, where all these little incidents get picked up on, they get to the finish line. And I mean, when you speak to a rider in the aftermath of a finish, they're totally wired. They're kind of, it's great as a journalist to get access to them because you never know what they're going to say. And often these things come out in the heat of that moment. They're fired up. They haven't had a chance to reflect on what's gone on or calm down. Their heart's racing. Their adrenaline's still pumping. And so you do get these flames of passion, I guess, these reactions to what's gone on. And I don't...
Well, it is good, isn't it? Because it's before the PR people can get involved.
Yeah, man.
And tell them to calm down and think about what they say. So they're just reacting as if they're athletes, you know, in the heat of the moment. And I've got lots of memories of... I mean, I remember when I first started watching cycling and Bernardino clashed with Phil Anderson, which is, you know, a long, long time ago. And I think he blamed him for years afterwards, not just, you know, a couple of days. It went on and on. And I mean, have you got much experience of this, Chris? You know, riders saying inappropriate things on the finish line or swearing at each other or blaming each other?
I mean, I've heard plenty of things which I wouldn't be able to say because libel suits would probably come in and riders would probably never speak to me again. There was one such case at last year's tour, which, we'll just keep that private, shall we? But... it's not so much that I hear it a lot, but when we do hear it, I really enjoy it because we want our athletes to be human. We want them to be like yourself, Jeremy, and myself, you know, have disagreements with people. And if that means their laundry in public, well, then so be it. It means we can relate to them more. So, you know, I'm all for this, actually. And I think it's right that we are debating kind of its origins and how much it's progressing, but if there's a vote for more of it or less of it, I'm firmly in the more camp.
I mean, I guess it's always been there, but maybe it's just become a bit more pronounced, as you say, Pete, because of VAR, people watching other football specifically, obviously, and VAR now becoming so embedded in the outcome of football matches. But obviously in cycling, they don't actually see video or see the clips until they look at their phones after they get back to the team bus. But I just wondered if we thought that the big name riders like the Primoz Rogliczs and the Remco Evenepoel were the riders of that ilk were becoming too quick to kind of blame the lesser riders such as Fred Wright and Caden Groves.
Maybe there's an element of they feel like because they are the kind of the big names and the team leaders, the race winners or the guys that are kind of favourites to win races, that they have to speak up in these incidents. That they're almost... I mean, you mentioned Eno then. I mean, Eno is one of the riders that was famously like le patron. He oversaw of kind of ruled the peloton. He was in charge of what went on. And it's kind of, I guess, since the Lance Armstrong era, we haven't really seen a rider like that. And there's nobody who's kind of, everybody's got their own opinion. And partly that's kind of, that's fed also by the fact that everybody's got access to social media and everybody wants to see what's happening on social media. And, I don't know. I mean,
I can't believe you mentioned Lance Armstrong. What are you bringing him into our podcast for? It's ridiculous. Anyway, more of that later. So let's move on. In the past few days, I've been talking to French national champion Audrey Cordon-Rago, one of the most eloquent riders in the Women's World Tour. She's had a very tough 9 months, suffering a stroke, the collapse of a team she had signed up to and assisted in the building of, and then being forced to leave her subsequent team, ZAF, in Spain, after not being paid. We spoke as she made the long journey from a training camp in the south of France to her home in Brittany, and I asked her if after such a challenging winter, she had recovered from the personal disappointment of the collapse of the B&B project.
It went like much more personal than it went with ZAF in the end, because I knew everyone. I knew all the people who went without a word in December. And I also brought people with me in this project. That was also one of the reasons why I took it so personal, is because I felt so guilty. I felt myself super guilty when trusting them. This project was with the DNA of my region, with my DNA basically. And I had really a nice idea of which kind of team I would like to be part of, and I could build it from my hands.
Of course, after B&B, Audrey was then signed up by Spanish outfit Team ZAF. But as many of you will know, that didn't go well either. And she soon saw that the team was in no shape to be sending riders to Australia to race at the start of this season.
But I realised early January, when I was in training camp in Calpe, that they wanted to go faster than they were able to go.
Okay.
And to me, going to Australia when half of your team has no bike at home in January, it's not okay. And I had to fight to get my bike. My husband had to build my bikes at home, not receiving the right pieces. He had to build the bike of one of my teammates who is living not so far from me. And I was like starting to think, well, why are you racing in Australia if all those things are not done in Europe?
Pete and Chris, I mean, that's quite quite a shocking state of affairs, isn't it, for a new team to be launching into the racing scene in those conditions. What do you think we can learn from the whole Team ZAF meltdown?
I think one of the things that was interesting about it all was the fact that because ZAF was a continental team, the UCI, who were getting a lot of stick for the fact that riders weren't being paid and this team was failing to fulfill its obligations. The UCI were getting stick for this, but it was actually down to the Spanish Federation to kind of get ZAF into line and to make sure they stuck to the rules. I mean, the UCI is responsible for teams at World Tour level, but there are dozens and dozens of teams at continental level, whether they're on the men's side of the sport or on the women's side of the sport. There are dozens of them, and the UCI simply cannot oversee all of them. And I guess this highlights the problem that probably be found with a lot of federations. They're not keeping an eye on what these teams are doing. They're basically, a new team comes in, they're just kind of waving them through. They're not putting in the checks that need to be made to ensure that the riders are going to get paid, that they're going to get the equipment, that they're going to get what their contracts say they're meant to get. And I mean, that was the tragedy of the whole thing, that nobody was really, I mean, the team was shambolic. I mean, we've heard all kinds of stories from all other riders on the teams, riders being prevented from racing when they switched to new teams. It's just been an awful affair for all of the riders and staff that are involved.
I mean, I think it's one of the most embarrassing team kind of folds and collapses that I can think of in all the long years I've been working in cycling. And I mean, one of the things I said to Audrey was, I said, this is not a new story, and it's not, Chris, is it? It's something we've seen time and time again, especially, you know, in teams of lower status.
It absolutely is not. And I think we were just saying on our WhatsApp group maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago that the women's scene, disappointingly, is still like the Wild West in many situations. And this case is absolutely not unique. I think it was only Hayley Simmons, who was a multiple British time trial champion, saying on Twitter just a few weeks ago that in a team a few years ago, she was bullied and threatened by the team's management after only receiving 2% of her promised salary. Since then, she remains unpaid. And it shames cycling, I think, that these cases continue to happen. While we haven't got any information right now that there are other cases like this happening, I think we can probably bet with confidence that ZAF are not the only team acting like this. And it was interesting speaking to someone quite close to the story maybe 10 days ago, and he said to me that the fear in Spain amongst those who are closer to the story is that ZAF are going to take their revenge on riders in ways that they haven't yet announced. But it feels like they really want to go out with a bang. They feel like they've been treated unfairly. They feel like the media criticism hasn't been warranted. And if they're going to go out, they're going to go out bringing everyone down with them. So it feels like the story isn't over. And even though Pete's obviously mentioned that it's not up to the UCI to deal with this, I think it actually is.
Sigma Sports, where, don't forget, you can find everything you need from a new road bike to a wardrobe refresh. Sigma Sports, where you get the products you want from the brands you love. Sigma Sports keeps you moving, whether you're a commuter, racer, or social rider. With fast shipping, easy returns, and industry-leading customer service, shop in-store or online at sigmasports.com. So our final story in this episode concerns the news that Lance Armstrong is going into space. Yes, the bike riding, Uber investing, art collecting podcast host is one of a dozen stars of a new reality TV show called Stars on Mars. According to Fox TV, Stars on Mars will send these famous rookie space travellers where no one has gone before and reveal who has what it takes to survive life on Mars. Well, given that he complained about the long transfers when he rode the Giro, I'm not sure how Lance will adapt to the 7-month flight to Mars, nor the thin air, given too that he never won a stage on the Ventoux. Anyway, with Star Trek Ledge, William Shatner in the hot seat at Mission Control, it will be interesting to see if he's stricter with Armstrong than the UCI ever was. Whatever, Lance is looking pretty sharp in the publicity shots, and given his competitive nature, which we know sometimes strays a little over the line, I'm looking forward to the moment when he makes a zipped lips gesture to co-star Ariel Winter. Certainly he will be good value, just as anyone who knows him will testify. But maybe skip the victory speech this time, bud.
I'm sorry for you. I'm sorry you can't dream big. And I'm sorry you don't believe in miracles.
Pete, do you believe in miracles? Will you be watching Stars on Mars?
I probably won't be too disappointed if I can't pick it up on Netflix or Amazon Prime or wherever else it might be. But I mean, it's just pretty extraordinary news, isn't it? I mean, I think the first thing, I mean, you kind of inserted a few cracks of your own, but the first thing that went through my head was, does his ban on competing in any kind of sport extend beyond the Earth's atmosphere? Would he be able to, if they actually organised
Pete, he's not really going to Mars, okay?
Isn't he?
I think he'll be in a luxury hotel where, just across the lot from the studio, I'd imagine.
Are you saying you doubt Lance Armstrong?
No. I believe that this is a studio-based entertainment offering. I don't think they've actually built a studio on Mars. I don't think so.
Oh, I'm really disappointed now.
I mean, the thing is, you want to watch him in a kind of moon rover, don't you, or something like that, or, you know, weightless in space. That's, you know, I mean, Lance, whatever you say about him, I think he's quite entertaining sometimes because he's provocative and outrageous and all those things. But I think, you know, anybody listens to the podcast, anybody's ever met him, anybody's ever interviewed him knows that he's, you know, he can't, he's, how shall I put it, he's engaging company. So I would have thought that, you know, that a lot of the screen time will be based around him. But do we think that this is something that will draw in a cycling audience? I mean, I'm assuming that, you know, a massive cycling audience will be watching it.
I think it might draw in a tiny little bit of a cycling audience. I think Lance Armstrong still holds an appeal for those who are not embedded within cycling. I mean, I'm sure you two have it on a regular basis. When you meet someone who doesn't know cycling, the first thing they ask you is, are they still doping? How's Lance Armstrong doing?
He's on Mars. That's what you can say now.
He's riding a gravel bike on the red planet.
It's like Napoleon on the Isle of Elba. He's on Mars.
No, but I just think, I mean, maybe I'm just speaking for myself here, but I think the cycling world's just fed up with Lance Armstrong, no? He's there, he exists, but who cares?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because this is a guy who is in his pomp. I'll just suit when Hein Verbruggen was president of the UCI, and there were loads of rumours about how Lance was going to buy the Tour de France and buy out ASO, and he had a consortium and blah blah blah, you know. And he and Verbruggen were going to move into being the world's, you know, leading race promoters. I mean, that's not the first time we've heard stories about the Tour being bought, or, you know, the whole structure of cycling changing. But it's if you think what could have happened, what might have happened, I mean, you know, it's extraordinary that he's now in a reality game show. It seems he's now in the kind of, you know, the extraterrestrial version of I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here.
He's not the first, though, is he? It was only a few years ago that Bradley Wiggins went on Jump, I think it was called.
That's true.
He tried to learn how to ski jump.
Yeah,
I'm not sure how he did, though. I don't think he was quite as good as Roglic.
Didn't he walk off the show? Didn't Bradley walk off the show?
He got injured, didn't he? Didn't he get injured?
Maybe limped off the show then. I thought he didn't. He didn't stay on the show, though, did he?
I don't think. No.
Well, anyway, cycling stars and reality TV. It's a great theme, and I'm sure we'll return to it. And definitely, I'll be watching. I'll be watching clips anyway. Maybe I won't subscribe to Fox, but I'll be watching clips online. So there you have it. Big thanks to Pete and Chris and producer Will. We will be back later this week to bring you more views and news from World Cycling. But for now, keep watching the stars.